Hello everyone, this is Carla Atherton, the director of the Healthy Family Formula, and I am here to deliver to you a Q&A session. Our first one, actually, in fact, of the Family Health Revolution health coaching program. So what we're going to do here with these sessions is keep them pretty informal. I just want to answer questions that come up with people. I am recording them because I have a very busy family and a busy life, and we live in the country, so it's a terrible, I mean, sometimes the connection is terrible and we had a couple of problems before, and I'm just not really into doing that, and I don't think anybody else is too. So without wasting your time, I figured that if I recorded the sessions, that would be much better. So hopefully you're not hearing too much wind noise here. I'm actually outside and it's just beautiful, glorious day, and I'm tired of being inside, quite frankly. And really, if you start feeling yucky, I mean, I tell you guys to do that, and I better do that myself. If you start feeling gross, yucky, you need to move around, get the heck out. So I'm outside recording this today for you, and I'm really actually enjoying my time doing this. So let's get started. So I would like to take about 20 minutes or so for each of these Q&A sessions. If there are more questions for that time, for that month, I will actually record two separate sessions, because I think 20 minutes is long enough to sit and listen to something. We're all busy parents, caregivers, and I think that to keeping it down to 20 minutes or so should be really nice and manageable for everybody. So let's get started. So I've had several questions that I'm just going to bring up here right now, and they're very interesting questions and really sort of like span the ages and the gamut of what we might be running into. A lot of you guys might be running into at this point. So I'm just going to get started reading the first one. So first question, I have heard that diet plays a role in hyperactivity, but my doctor says that when we eat, or what we eat is fine, and changing it will only upset our son and will not change his behavior. What do you think, Carla? Have you seen any kids with ADHD improve with diet? Yeah, I have. My answer to this question is just like, I think, and my research has told me, and my experience with children, is that diet is a no-brainer when it comes to ADHD. That when I say, I don't mean anybody's stupid for not trying it or not knowing about it, but what I'm saying is that diet is key when you're dealing with children who have ADHD-like behaviors. And so, if you were to, I have a longer presentation about ADHD, but in a nutshell, ADHD is a set of symptoms. It's not actually a diagnosable disease. It's like there are a lot of conditions like that are a cluster of symptoms, and they could come from many, many different sources. So the reasons for that, the underlying causes, could be many, and actually it could be one, it could be a lot of them, but there are, so what we want to do is focus on what that is. What's the underlying cause of these behaviors? This is not a neurological issue. This is not something you can do a test for and say, hey, look, he's got this blood marker, or she's got, you know, this measurement, you know. You can't do that. Really, it's a matter of symptoms, and the diagnostic is actually really listing off of those symptoms and how many of those symptoms they have, and it's observation of behavior, really, and ability to learn and focus. But there's no other physiological test for ADHD. So again, it's a cluster of symptoms, a cluster of behavioral exhibition of behavior. So again, okay, so what I would tell you, and is really fitting for these first few, I guess, presentations, the quick start presentations, the foundations of health, is that I would run through those foundations, and one of them is definitely diet. So, you know, I wouldn't ignore anything like sleep, exercise, rest, you know, reducing screen time, reducing stress. Oh, I just said stress, stress. I saw something, you know, the recording just skipped. I think that diet is actually really a big issue when we're talking about ADHD. And let me tell you why. When we have things like food sensitivities, for instance, this is a little bit more tweaky-tweak, you know, to know if your kids are actually reacting to a particular food. But this can cause behaviors that are hyperactive, quote unquote, in how we observe them. And so kids have trouble focusing. They can crash in the middle of the day. They can actually get really super out of control or hyper. They can get depressed. They can, you know, go up and down the gamut for behaviors and really actually sometimes can't even control themselves. So, I mean, this is a really big deal when we think about, you know, if we're diagnosing children with ADHD, and really it could be just a matter of the food they're eating. And actually, I'll give you some examples. Okay, so I had one family that I actually knew personally, and their son was just off the rails. Like, he couldn't be invited to parties. He was really disruptive. The other kids were starting to not like him. You know, it was really a challenge for him to be out in the world, you know, never mind, you know, just coping with life at home. Like, he couldn't even be out in the world really without having some kind of incidents or issue. And it was really affecting his self-esteem, his time with friends, his time with family, his whole life really. And so, you know, of course he was diagnosed with ADHD, but what they did was they found that he was actually reactive to sugar. And sugar is a reactive food in many ways. It's inflammatory. It causes blood sugar spikes and then a subsequent crash. So you have all kinds of mood issues like that. It's really toxic to the brain. The rest of the organs. It causes insulin resistance and later on in life, type 2 diabetes. And actually, type 2 diabetes is showing up in children. So, you know, let's not forget the sugar is actually quite poisonous when it's ingested in big amounts. So this child, there was more to it than that for him. It wasn't just that. And that can actually be an instance where sugar is affecting behavior and can cause ADHD-like behaviors leading to diagnosis. But also for him, it was compounded because he was actually reactive to sugar in particular. So what happens with that is you have all the normal stuff, like, you know, that sugar does to the body, and it can actually cause problems for any child. But it also caused extra trouble for him because he was actually particularly reactive to sugar in particular. So it was causing all kinds of inflammation and problems for him, more so than even other kids. So, you know, I've had kids who've had these issues relating to gluten, to corn, you know, all the major food groups that, you know, kids are, or actually people in general, have been found to be reactive to. So those top foods, gluten, corn, soy, dairy, gluten, corn, soy, dairy, eggs. Sorry, there we go. And so those can really exacerbate the system, and any kind of inflammation or reaction can affect any part of the body. So, you know, you can have issues like eczema, asthma, you know, other atopic conditions. You can have, ADHD-like behaviors as well. So it's not just the ADHD behaviors that these food sensitivities can cause. So anyway, food sensitivities. So again, you know, I was actually talking to another person. I ran into her in the mall, and my son used to play soccer with her son, and they struggled so much, and I really felt for this boy in this family. They were the sweetest family, you know, Scottish mom. I just remember her cheering in the stands all the time, like, what would she say all the time? She would say, unlucky, unlucky, when when they would have some trouble or the other team would get the ball. She would always yell unlucky in her really beautiful Scottish accent. But I ran into them in the mall, and I asked how her son was doing, because I knew they really struggled with his moods. And he was diagnosed with ADHD, and I'm not even sure what other diagnoses he had received. And I said, you know, have you looked into gluten? And just, you know, just tried that. And she said, oh, well, we were going to try it. We tried for a couple of weeks and it didn't do any good. And the doctor said that it wasn't going to do any good. And I thought, no way. Because for one thing, if you are looking into a food issue relating to ADHD, you need to give it way more than 2 weeks. You need to actually clear the system, settle down the immune system, and then reintroduce. But first, see if the symptoms will alleviate. And sometimes that is part of the puzzle, but not all of it. So, you know, it might help and it might actually be an issue, but you still need to kind of dig in and see if there's anything else. So it could be partially done, and then people think, well, it's no big deal. And then they keep feeding the children whatever that food is that could be a problem. And indeed, it's exacerbating the problem once again. So I think that, you know, playing around with diet, finding a really good practitioner, or, you know, even coming to me, I would be happy to help. So in a nutshell, I think that diet is definitely a huge issue when it comes to ADHD behaviors, even more so than some others. And I would also look into things like subluxations that a chiropractor can help you with. You know, sometimes righting that nervous system and getting, you know, everything flowing right again is a really big help, as well as learning problems. So, you know, learning problems is actually a red flag. Okay, so, you know, that there might be subluxations or food sensitivities, or you know, some need for the nervous system to be corrected, or brain body communication, you know, or, you know, even things like a really poor diet that will lead to malnourishment or malnutrition, bad gut, you know, gut dysbiosis, which is, you know, we've gone through in the modules as well. So, you know, dysbiosis as well as leaky gut, because that can actually, you know, have whole proteins of foods, cause reactivity in the body, and actually inflame the brain. So those things I would not discount. I would actually think that they were extremely important to uncover. And, you know, all of the foundations, so the sleep, rest, diet, exercise, stress reduction is huge, like I was saying before. And, you know, really, I think along the lines of stress reduction in children who have ADHD, many times they're feeling overstimulated, so they act out. And sometimes, you know, it's kind of like the opposite of what children who have autism do. Well, sometimes they do act out, but more so retreat from that whole sensory overload. And with ADHD, you know, I think a lot of kids actually exhibit these behaviors because of being overstimulated through things like blue lights, you know, later at night, disrupting their sleep-wake cycle, you know, not getting enough rest, and also, you know, technology, because we're in this age where kids are playing a lot on their devices, and especially the handheld individual devices. And, you know, they're moving even away from the family computer and into their rooms. You know, they have TVs in their rooms, they have videos on all the time, they're constantly overstimulated. And it does physiological damage, as well as mental, emotional damage, as well as, you know, lack of paying attention to other things like diet, rest, exercise, you know, in because it's replaced those sorts of activities that encourage a good diet, rest, and exercise. So that's another thing to really be aware of. And there are modules about this that we have in the program as well. So revisit those, please. And I have a piece that I wrote that you can find on the website and also in the members area, where I go through media, technology, Wi-Fi, all that stuff, with some tips and strategies to reduce that and see if that might be your child's problem as well. So there's another thing that I want to mention as far as ADHD goes. And I know your question was about diet, and which is, like I said, it's number one. I mean, that is number one for as far as I go. I think too, communication and connection, because a lot of these kids, even if they have physiological issues, ADHD isn't, a solely behavioral problem. I think the behavior is actually the symptom of what's going on underneath. So under the hood, really. So what's going on under, what's underlying that behavior. But also there needs to be some way to communicate with these children while they're healing, while they're still struggling, and to repair afterward. So let's say you do bring your child back from that, you know, really difficult time with these symptoms, and you need a good way to continue on with this, because the behavior might be something that will be a residual effect. So I've been, you know, researching a lot these days about compassionate communication, and it's just beautiful. I don't know where it was all my life. You know, I had a few of the concepts down, but I didn't actually do exactly what Marshall Rosenberg tells you to do in these steps. And I'm not really one for formula for parenting, but I really am one for concepts and ideas and ways to actually become better compassionate parents that other really wonderful people can offer. And this is one. It's called nonviolent communication. Or some people call it compassionate communication, which, you know, I like. I mean, I like both terms, but sometimes nonviolent makes us feel like that we're being violent. And nobody wants to identify with violence. But, you know, any sort of thing that hurts somebody, Marshall considers violent. So, but for any parent, this is actually going into my program, the Healthy Mom, Healthy Baby program, as a suggested piece of research or, you know, to put on your bookshelf. And any parent, any grandparent, really honestly, for school teachers, people who have any sort of conflict in relationship, you know, all the way to gangs, to, you know, diplomats, to, you know, in policy making, workplace, and government. Okay, my program stopped for a second, so hopefully you got that. I said, and government as well. So, but in relation to children with ADHD, I think that, you know, often they're frustrated with their ability to communicate. And really, we try to preach and teach all the time to our children. And children who are struggling really need us to shut up and listen sometimes. So instead of, this is my suggestion to you. Rather than correct the situation or to correct that child, try perhaps to listen to that child and reflect. So one of the real basic, I guess, strategies to do this, or methods, I suppose it would be, to practice this, is to actually ask a question, you know, what's going on, or let that child tell you what's going on if they're already kind of ranting about it. And reflect, only reflect what they say to you. So if they say, I'm really frustrated, and like, you know, I hate you. Okay, well, let's take it off of me. Are you angry? You're angry. And they say, yes, I'm angry. You're frustrated. Yes, I'm so frustrated. And, you know, so really just try to reflect what they're telling you. And then they will, until they're done. And then you're able to connect with that child. They feel heard. They feel important. And then you have a better chance at moving forward to maybe some solutions that you could come to together. Now, this is a big process to be learned. I highly recommend the book that we're actually reading right now. It's called Nonviolent Communication, exactly what I'm talking about here, by Marshall Rosenberg. And give it a good read, because I think that it would really do wonders for you and your child, on top of everything that you would be addressing as far as diet and lifestyle goes. So I think for you, with your child, who has ADHD, I think that is not a life sentence. I actually think that ADHD is very much a condition that can be addressed and recovered. So all the best to you with that. Now, already I'm going to go over. I said 20 minutes. I'm going to move on to the next issue here. And you know what? I can actually be a little shorter with this, because I wrote it's not totally comprehensive, because I'm going to be releasing a comprehensive piece about this. But the question is surrounding, you know, screen time. And I did touch on it a little bit with this last answer. So the question is, even though it's summer, my sons still sit inside much of the day playing video games. And I thought with school out, they would be outside more. Man, I know that feeling. I am stressed about this, but don't know how to change it. They are 12 and 14. Okay, so 14's getting tough. You know, 12, it's a little easier to, you know, do the classic things like set boundaries and, you know, limitations, and, you know, encourage people to go outside. 14's getting to that age where it's getting a little tougher to do that. They want to make their own decisions. They're a little harder to convince. And, you know, all the stuff that I'm learning about with compassionate communication and nonviolent communication, you know, really, we can't actually make our children do anything, really. I mean, we actually can't. I mean, they might actually do it, but if it's begrudging, I mean, eventually you're going to have resentment. So we really have to, it's tricky, really tricky. But I think that we can do that with some clear boundaries and some clear communication about how we feel about these things. So, so here are some suggestions. So like I said, boundaries. So, you know, if you could come together as a family and decide what's a reasonable amount of time for you to be on this. We all need to be on board with this and agree wholeheartedly, because otherwise you're going to be chasing them off that thing 24 hours a day, and that's all you're going to do all summer, which is probably not what you want to do. So if you can come to some kind of resolution together that you can both agree on that seems reasonable, for me, I mean, my tendency in my, you know, I would really love to never see it happening. I mean, never. I maybe like an hour, but really I'm a reader. I love to be outside. I run. I practice yoga. My kids, you know, they have things they love to do like that. And whenever, and I'm sure your children do too. So it's really difficult to see them kind of entertaining themselves with things that, you know, dots on a screen. That's what I call it. So it feels like a real waste of life. And so, you know, let's not panic. You know, I remember when I was a child, we didn't have this as much, but we did have Atari. I'm dating myself. And, you know, Sega later on when I was an older, when I was, you know, encroaching on my 20s. But I think, you know, but there was a clear boundaries. The games weren't as real. They weren't as stressful, right? So if we think about what it's doing to our children's brains, we're more inclined to say, okay, look, we need to have some limitations on this because it's causing overstimulation, it's causing stress, it's causing ADHD-like behaviors, it's causing learning disabilities and disengagement in life, and perhaps even apathy, lack of exercise, and, you know, some really and physiological things that are go beyond, you know, how the brain is functioning, but also, you know, like I said, there's less inclination to pay attention to what we're eating, to connect with family and friends, to get outside, get that vitamin D, that vitamin N that Richard Louv talks about, which is nature, connecting to the self and spirit and knowing themselves. So what happens to creativity? There's no creativity in playing a video game. Like, there's zero. It's really solely being in an alternate world. And it's very profound and it's addictive, and it can be fun, but soul sucking. It can squelch some things that, you know, would be a creative way to live. And so it really does steal a lot from our children. I don't want to press the panic button, but I really want to impress on parents that this is not a benign issue. You know, for someone to say, oh, I'm so tired of my children playing video games, it's really not anything that's just that we should sweep under the rug. So I think that if anybody has suggestions too to other parents, please do post in any of our social media or our groups. And that those can be found in any of the website or any of our emails easily. So let's talk about this some more. I think that we need to work as parents to find out what we can do to minimize the really poor outcomes that we're going to have and are having and seeing in our children. And Victoria Dunkley is an excellent resource. Dr. Victoria Dunkley, I've worked with her extensively over the last year on this issue. She wrote a book about this. You know, have a look in our books section on our website and grab a copy. So Dr. Victoria Dunkley, and I think her, what is it called? Reclaim Your Child's Brain. Sorry, I'm having a brain problem myself just now. Okay, so it's harder with older ones, like I said, but it's doable. And the best thing to do is to start earlier. And I think when you have older ones, maybe you can reason with them more, or not just reason with them, but really get them to understand why this is important, and try to help them to find what they like to do, and really encourage that kind of activity as well. You know, spending a little more time being present, less time on these devices yourself, leading by example. I have an entire presentation about this that should be in your members area, as well as just a copy of the text on the website too. So yeah, so if they're busy, you know, it helps them to pursue other, and you know, help them to pursue other interests, you know, be, like I said, being there. They may need more responsibilities, you know, so are you doing all the dishes and cleaning up while they're playing video games? No, no, you know, this is a time for everybody to pitch in. And so, you know, there was a time when, like, it would just be insane for your kids to be sitting around doing that. Like, I mean, people had to help out, you know, there was things to do and responsibilities. And so let's not forget about that. You know, look at what I'm, look at maybe some reasons why they might be retreating into this sort of activity as well. And so, again, you know, check out the materials, and we'll leave that question for now. But we're not going to leave it forever. We're going to keep coming back to that throughout the program and the years ahead. Okay, so number three. Okay, so hi, Carla. Thank you for the great information about sleep, but can you tell me a bit more about what I can do about my 15-year-old daughter who says she can't get to sleep at night? She's really unbearable to be around most days, and I'm thinking it's because of her sleep. Yeah. Been there, done that. Okay, really. Okay, sleep, this is another issue. And again, I'm going down to the foundations because they all are actually really interrelated. So we can say they're all separate things like diet, rest, exercise, sleep, stress reduction, you know, connection, downtime, those things. But really, they are interconnected. So your diet can affect your sleep. Your sleep can affect your stress levels. Your stress levels can affect, again, sleep or your diet even, because it can affect digestion. So all of them work together synergistically in one group of subsystems for the whole system. Okay, so it's very important when you're addressing sleep that it's not just sleep that you need to look at. So first thing first, again, you know, like we're talking about with ADHD, sleep can be affected by diet. Okay, so let's say they're eating something that is not agreeing with them. They're eating too late. Maybe she is having trouble, you know, with a specific food that she's reactive to that will actually disturb her sleep. So poor food habits, you know, maybe she's eating quite, I don't know if she's eating a lot of junk food or, you know, eating a lot of carbohydrates late into the night that are, you know, spiking her blood sugar. Does she drink coffee? Does she drink coffee later in the day? Because it's a stimulant, you know, you don't want to be stimulated at that time of day. And where is she at in her menstrual cycle when she's having her sleep problems? So it could be hormonal as well. So she could be, also having trouble with stress. Okay, so stress will affect the hormone levels, and it'll put your cortisol up at night when it's supposed to be down, and it could actually stay up all day. She could be agitated, anxious. So I would need to know a little bit more about what her symptoms are. But, you know, generally speaking, it could be hormonal, it could be diet related. And hormones can be affected by different things, like I said, her menstrual cycle, and also her stress level. It could actually even start from a really poor, poor sleep hygiene in her room. You know, so does she have a whole bunch of blue lights and a TV and their alarm clock by her head? Does she use her cell phone as an alarm clock? Because that will stimulate the brain for hours after it's being used. Does she use handheld devices quite a lot, texting friends, waiting for texts to get back? That will stimulate the brain and not allow it to rest. So perhaps some of those habits, and sleeping with the light on, maybe, you know, that needs to be dark in the bedroom. So again, those habits can actually lead to a disruption in the circadian rhythm. So there might not have been an issue before those habits started to take place or to be practiced, I should say. And then after this, it could have caused a disruption in circadian rhythm. So her body might be actually saying, I need to be awake at this time of day. It's got to be day. The lights are on. There's this blue light in my eyes or, you know, reaching my brain. Got to be day. And so then she's going to have a lot of trouble getting to sleep. And then if she does that, and when she does get to sleep, it's not a restful sleep. There's not a lot of melatonin being produced. And melatonin is the master antioxidant. So now if you don't create this, if you don't have enough melatonin, you don't get the rest and repair that you need, and you wake up a bear. I mean, anybody will know if you don't have good rest, you wake up terrible. I mean, you don't have a good day. I don't know anybody who ever has a good day when they have trouble sleeping. So just think about this kid and what she must be going through every day, thinking that this is it for me. This is how I'm supposed to feel. I'm cranky. That person's making me mad. I don't really even care to negotiate or to be nice. I just want to glare, growl, and just get out of my way, right? So that will happen if you don't have a good sleep. And not only the mood issues, but also physiological trouble. So this is when kids have things that affect their actual bodies. And, you know, even, I mean, I'm not going to go there with saying, you know, lack of melatonin causes cancers. But with a lack of things like the antioxidants, we become oxidized, we age quicker, and we are more susceptible to big diseases like cancer. So this is actually a really big issue. Digestive problems are also related. So, you know, if we talk about gut health as well, you know, that can actually cause trouble with sleeping. It can cause, actually trouble sleeping can actually cause gut problems as well. So be aware that her diet may be a contributing factor and her lifestyle practices disrupting her circadian rhythm. And also things like, okay, none of us really want to know this and think, okay, well, that's not me. We live in the in a first world country. But often parasites and infection can cause people not to be able to sleep. And you want to be watching for that because actually 80% of our human population on Earth has had or has right now parasites. And it's really not uncommon. So, you know, you can test with a functional medicine doctor for parasites if you suspect anything, if you see anything disruptive in the gut, you know, in digestion, maybe something in the stool that looks a little odd. But a stool test wouldn't be out of the norm, silly to do a stool test if you found that you've tried to lots of different methods to fix lifestyle and diet issues. And so I would, you know, look for that. Okay, so I'm just looking at what else I wanted to mention here for you. Okay, so a disrupted circadian rhythm will affect hormones and also neurotransmitter production, and so it can disrupt the neurotransmitters. So, you know, you can have low serotonin and high dopamine, which makes for an angry, unhappy person. Serotonin is that happy neurotransmitter that you need to produce. And poor diet will actually also affect that, because you need adequate protein to produce all of these neurotransmitters. You need adequate fat as well. So those two things are things that teenagers quite often don't get, or else they get a lot of fat, like in French fries, but it's the terrible fat. So that can affect neurotransmitter production. The dopamine is actually the neurotransmitter that is the get up and go motivator. So, you know, let's say you have a kid that's just like dragging, but still not sleepy, you know, but there are all kinds of different combinations that you can have that can create trouble sleeping. And also, you know, to have high cortisol at night actually doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to stay that way forever. They can actually be on their way to an adrenal crash. So, you know, it could be their adrenals pumping out cortisol and just before that point where it can't actually do it anymore, because and it's like stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, and it's trying so hard, and then it crashes, the whole system crashes. So then you have this situation where that kid's going to be tired all the time, and we're going to see this more and more, and we already have been seeing this more and more in our teen population because of their stress levels. So that's another area you can look into, is how stressed is that kid. And it's not just about worrying about the next day, and you know, we think it's just stuff worth thinking about and we can change our thoughts. It's actually physiological what happens to us when we have stressful lives, stressful practices. So help that kid reduce stress all day long so that they can actually take that time and cut everything off at a certain time of day. I don't know what's negotiable for you and your child and what she's willing to do, but if she's really on board with this and trying to fix this, you may be able to have a real window into opportunity to help her through. And so if she's willing to work on it and thinks it's a problem herself and she wants to fix it, you really do have a good opportunity here. So my suggestion would be for that is to, you know, help her to reduce some of the stress, you know, and there are mind body practices she can do. She can try some meditation to settle her mind. Make sure that her room is clear of any sort of electronics, including her phone. I mean, if she's willing, just say, hey, look, let's just leave it outside of your bedroom and see how that helps. And just turn that stuff off for a bit. You know, I know you really want to talk to your friends. Maybe give them a call on the landline and just visit, you know, for a while rather than being on a cell phone. And then try to cut everything off, you know, just really settle down, do self-care, you know, take that time to play cards, massage each other's feet, or if she has her little beauty routine she does at night, encourage that to happen, you know, well before it's time to kind of rest and repair and turn down the lights. You know, make sure that there's a lot of stress-free time and connection, you know, at least an hour before bed. And that would really help to reduce the stress. Also magnesium, you know, making sure there are a lot of minerals and a good diet. Again, that's another thing I'm such a proponent of. So those are some suggestions for you, and I hope they help. And I think that you'd have a much happier child if you can incorporate at least some of those things and in your day. Okay, number four. Oh, I'm like twice as long. I'm sorry, I just do this. There's so much to share. Okay, so you can listen to half of it and like listen to the other half later. Okay, so number four, I only have two more questions left, okay? So how do I start a meditation practice with my children who are 5 and 9? I'm very inspired to start them early, exclamation mark, yay. So do you know where I can start? I'm lost. Okay, so yeah, I mean, there are tons of websites that talk about meditation with children. One piece that I loved, and I think I actually posted in the Healthy Family Formula on the page, or on our page, I think I posted it there, was where the school, instead of giving detention to children that they had, that were sort of acting out in school, not listening or whatever they were doing, instead of detention, they actually had them come after school to a meditation. Or at the time, I don't even know what time of day it was, but beautiful. I think that is what we should do with every single child. Not as a timeout, as punishment, but as a check-in. So that, what do you need, kiddo? This to bring yourself inward and actually calm your nervous system, reduce your stress that's causing these behaviors in the first place, or even connect with those kids is, like, I think that is absolutely brilliant and kicks the butt of any sort of punitive punishment that we are doing nowadays in our schools. I will frankly say that meditation, teaching your children meditation, is one of the best skills you can ever teach your kids, and it should be part of every single school curriculum if we can have that happen. So parents, you know, I really, who asked this question about your 5 and 9-year-old, I commend you, mama, on this, or papa, whoever asked this question. So I commend you on this this initiative. So, okay, so you can find a lot of little 5-minute meditations that go through the body, you know, start with the toes and work up. I think kids love those ones that they actually have guided meditation. I could say, you know, focus on your toes and breathe in through your toes and out through. You can lead them yourself, just leading them through relaxing every single part of their body. And, you know, when I was a kid, we did a music class. We had a music class, and the one thing I remember about that class was the terrible carpet in the room, and the second thing I remembered was doing a relaxation session with one of the teachers. That's all I remember. All of my years spending that time in that room. That's all I remember, and I was like, "What is this?" I didn't even know what it was, and it was years until I actually discovered meditation for myself. But it was the best thing I had ever experienced. And I didn't have the easiest home life, you know? So it was something it was foreign to me to feel like that, that relaxed and that calm. So, okay. So, again, you can do this yourself, mom or dad or grandma, grandpa, whoever. You can all lie on the floor and just relax. And sometimes when I do this, I actually touch my children, like a shavasana at the end of yoga. So, you know, sometimes I have, you know, like kind of just, you know, lifted their arm and shook it a bit and put it down and said, just relax there. And so just to get them all settled and ready to lay, because sometimes children can't sit. They actually prefer to do the laying down meditation where you bring them through all their body parts and allow and tell them to relax each and every one. You can lay with them and do it too. But keep it short unless they're really enjoying it. Unless they're laying there going, oh, mom, I can't get enough, and it's you've got the time. But 5 minutes is enough. 5 minutes is enough. And you know, one really simple one you can do with them is tell them to breathe into their belly and out. And always through the nose, right? Breathe into the belly and out. Inhale Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. Inhale. Exhale. And you know, another way to do this is to play a song that they like that's very gentle and calm, and just sit with your eyes closed and listen. So that's another nice one. Or even an instrumental music. You know, some nice healing sounds that you can find on the internet, on YouTube, anywhere. Get some CDs. There are many, many ways to do this, but my advice, or what I found that works really, really well with the little guys, is that they feel great, they feel nurtured, and they are attentive, and that it's simple and short. It does not need to be long or painful or go, we have to meditate now. It's like, okay, let's do our meditation. This, you know, okay, everybody's gather around and sit. It's all about the attitude and how you present it to them. So if you present it in a way that they're excited to do it, go for it. And I also want to tell you that there are other ways to meditate. It's not just about sitting, you know, like I said, you know, erect. Sometimes your children, you might want to sit in a circle and everybody sit up and you do a guided 5 minutes. You know, you go and you're guided to be on the beach and, you know, with the sand between your toes. Or, you know, you're guiding them to watch their breath. Or you're guiding them to think of the number one and then one. With every breath, one. Because what you're doing is teaching them to just allow other thoughts to just sort of melt away. You're saying thank you for the thought, and then you leave the thought. But you're wanting them to focus on the here and now, which is their breath, which is whatever you're guiding them through, which is the toe, and then the heel, and relaxing every single part. And you don't even realize how much tension there is in your body until you actually focus on releasing it. So, okay, so those are not the only ways to reach a meditative place. Walks help you to meditate. And when you do that, you focus on every single step. You focus on the bees. You focus on that butterfly flying. You don't just run past everything. So when they're teaching them to zero in on the little things in nature and in their environment is also meditative, noticing. Which is part of mindfulness, right? And also even when we eat, we have, you know, when people pray, that is a form of meditation to me. Or when they say thank you for this food, we just say thank you for this food, amen. Like that's what we say. It's simple, but it brings our focus to being mindful for what's in front of us right now. Reading can be meditative. I mean, especially poetry, or reading a poem out loud, a little bit of contemplation about that. Writing is very meditative. I know it's cathartic, at least, especially for me. I'm a writer, essayist. Literature is my background, actually. So creativity and music, you know, even dance. So, and, you know, sports such as golf, those ones where you really have to focus, is extremely meditative. So let's not discount those things we do in life that isn't necessarily just meditation, that we would consider meditation, but our meditative practices. Yoga. I mean, yoga is a body, a movement meditation. Same thing with Tai Chi. You know, some people even get into the groove with long distance running. So children can do a lot of those things, you know, but I think even just walking with them, especially the little guys, noticing things, brings a sense of peace that is much like meditation. And, you know, I think gratitude is also the ultimate meditation. You know, feeling grateful for what you have, it just pushes all of those, it lets all of those other thoughts and stressors just fall to the wayside when your children are encouraged to be grateful. And, you know, there are all kinds of things you can do to encourage that kind of gratitude. One book I would suggest would be The Seven Spiritual Laws for Parents. And it's so simple. And some people might read it and go, ah, it's too simple. But you know what? Just keep it in front of you and on your desk or your, you know, like on your shelf. And just refer back to it. It's a quick read. It's well worth the read. It's by Deepak Chopra. And he, you know, he just talks about some ideas to keep that your child's spirit nourished, because we often miss nurturing the spirit. We think about diet, we think about rest, we think about exercise, but the spirit can get can fall by the wayside, but it's just as important and maybe even more important than all the rest. So good on you. And with that meditative practice, and there's another presentation I have about this, about meditation as well and meditating with your children, but there is also, I mean, there are also physiological things that happen with meditation, very healing. It actually even, I mean, it actually has been proven to lengthen the telomeres, which are the protective caps on our DNA, which is, I mean, that's insane. Like, if you think about the power of meditation to do that, I think, again, every child should learn how to do this, especially in our world. Okay, so I think I'm going to get to number 5 before my kids get home. They're getting home from work any second, and I way run over my 20 minutes. All right, so number 5. My 4-year-old is having meltdowns and tantrums on a daily basis, and it is really affecting the rest of us in our home. We try to talk to her about her behavior, but I don't think she understands or is so caught up in her fits that she doesn't hear us, ! She usually has them in the afternoon and especially in the evening after supper time or when she doesn't get her way in the store. I can't even take her out anymore. Okay, yeah, this is a big issue for parents of little ones, you know, and again, I'm going to tell you that many of the fixes for such behavioral issues are the same as if you have ADHD. It's the same if you have, you know, kids that can't sleep. You know, it's going back to the foundations. Okay, so what's she eating? I mean, often I'll see parents who have, you know, little ones, and they say, I don't know what her problem is, and this child is sucking on a sucker and just had fries and chicken fingers for supper, and so that kid is not going to have the tools to actually create the proper brain chemicals, the right nutrients to actually make her body run properly. She will not have that. And the sugar spikes with a dysregulated sugar for children is really extremely damaging. Like I said earlier in this Q&A session, it's damaging to the organs, to the eyes, to the brain. And it's really quite poisonous to have a high sugar diet. So that's like one of the first things. And again, sensitivities, food sensitivities, are very common nowadays, and to identify those is very important when you have a child who's having problems like meltdowns and tantrums, because very rarely do I think meltdowns and tantrums are solely behavioral. Okay? Rarely they are behavioral. Most of the time it's a combination that creates the perfect storm. And a lot of that has to do with what your child is eating and ingesting. Also, some children, and we haven't mentioned this yet, can have a sensitivity to chemicals. You know, maybe there's something in your air, in your environment. I mean, notice when these tantrums are happening, because it could be a matter of having Glade plugins in your house. And I'm telling you, if you have anything like that in your house, throw it in the garbage this minute. Like, turn this off, like pause it and go throw them out, because they're full of phthalates. They're not worth it. And what you can do instead is use something like an essential oil, which one of them is lavender. And essential oils actually work in the brain and body chemically. So they actually are ingested almost like a food when you inhale them. Or you can, some people do ingest them, but there are kind of rules, you know, cautions for that for children, which I have another article and presentation about that, that I can't quite get into with this in this amount of time that we have left. But just know that buying a diffuser and putting maybe a little bit of lavender into a bathtub, or diffusing it in a diffuser, putting it into some lotions that you can apply to their skin with the safe, most of them are safe for children, just inhaling them, from the bottle. Those are extremely helpful to actually, they do many, many things. Some of them are immune enhancers, some of them are very calming. Some of them are uplifting. The citrus oils are very uplifting and improve mood and serotonin levels because they work chemically in the body, okay? They actually change brain chemistry. They improve it. So, you know, chemical sensitivities could be an issue for your child. You know, so ditch all of the chemicals and bring in things like essential oils that not only smell good, okay, so the whole idea was to have your house smell good, but they kill bacterias, odors, viruses, some of them even kill parasites. You can clean your house with them, you can diffuse them, and to use something like lavender when you know that you're approaching that time when your child tends to have a trouble, and you'll calm her and soothe her with lavender, oils such as lavender. So there are many, many oils. There are lots of things you can look into and research as far as which oils are good for what. So anyway, okay, so I digress. Where was I? Okay, so I'm talking about oils. I'm talking about chemical sensitivity. Okay, so what's another reason? So a poor diet, lack of rest. Okay, so, and I don't just mean sleep. I think our little ones usually get enough sleep, although sometimes they get woken up because of mom and dad's work schedule. They got to get to a daycare or to some other care during the day. And if you're waking your little ones up, they might not be ready to get up. So you might have to back up that bedtime a little bit. The day before, really watch for that. If they're not getting up on their own, you're always having to drag them out. They're probably sleep deprived, and they'll have all those issues that we mentioned. We were talking about sleep earlier, that with the teenager that we were talking about. But rest. So do they get to rest? Do they get to sit and play? Do they have time to have some space? Because overstimulation is huge. And it's not just us adults that get stressed, and it's not just our teenagers. Our little ones are stressed. And that stress comes from all of the similar things that we talk about when we talk about stress for adults and for teenagers, which is environmental stress, you know, things and internal stress, and not just the mind, mental, emotional stress, but also physiological stress. So illness, bugs, bacteria, you know, parasites, all kinds of things like that. But also stress, and not just lack of being able to be heard. So when we're small, we're young, we can have some serious trouble dealing with that, because these children, they're young and their brain development is not at the stage where they can actually be reasoned with, and maybe they don't need to be. You know, that we do a lot of manipulating with those little guys. We cajole, we bribe, we, you know, force, and we don't listen. I can't say all of us parents don't listen, but you know, it's a tendency to teach people that, but parenting, you know, little ones, you parent by the iron fist, and I tend to disagree. I think to connect with those kids, to listen to them, to practice NVC, nonviolent communication, is really, really important. So they need a little bit of downtime and they need some connection. They need to feel heard. I know that I had my little niece over all weekend, and she was having some trouble. My children have arrived. Okay, she was having some trouble, and all I did was reflect what she said. You're frustrated. Yeah. You're angry. No. Okay, you're frustrated. Yes. It was frustrated. And then I could talk to her. She stopped crying. She stopped. So please do consider those things. And we'll get more into that. If you have more questions, anybody, about any of these topics, just post them into our social media. Facebook pages Facebook groups, and also our Green Nation group as well. So I hope you enjoyed this. I hope it was really helpful. And I know I enjoyed this outside in the beautiful sun, delivering these answers to your questions.